Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now here's Doug with our first story.
Thank you, Dale. I'm going to read this first story. Here's a couple, three on the front page, but this one is Deer to lay off 190 at the Waterloo plant. And its dateline is Waterloo. It says, Deere & Company on Monday announced its second layoff in Waterloo this spring. The company informed members of the workforce at its Waterloo operations that approximately 190 production employees would be placed on indefinite layoff effective June 22. Employees were told of the layoffs by factory leadership in meetings Monday. The company announced March 26 that 308 Waterloo employees would lose their jobs in late April. Each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility. John Deere Waterloo operations currently have about 5,000 total employees, with about 3,300 of them working in production and maintenance jobs, the company said in a statement Monday. The announcement comes 2 months after the company announced it would lay off 150 workers at its Ankeny location. Deere announced Thursday that its fiscal second quarter results beat Wall Street's expectations, but the company lowered its full-year profit forecast for a second time as farmers buy fewer tractors and other equipment as they deal with declining prices for their crops. The agricultural equipment manufacturer cut its profit outlook to $7 billion from a previous range of $7.5 billion to $7.75 billion. Before that, the company had forecast a 2024 profit between $7.75 billion and $8.25 billion. Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture anticipates that 2024 net farm income, which is a broad measure of profits, will total $116.1 billion. That's down 25.5% from a year earlier. Adjusting for inflation, net farm income is expected to be down 27.1% this year as farmers contend with lower prices for soybeans and corn. The USDA said that lower direct government payments and increased production costs were also weighing on farmers. For the 3 months ended April 28, Deere & Company earned $2.37 billion or $8.53 per share. A year earlier, it earned $2.86 billion or $9.65 per share. The difference easily beat the $7.86 per share that analysts polled by Zacks Investment Research were calling for. Revenue for the Moline-based company fell 12% to $15.24 billion. Its adjusted revenue, which excludes finance and interest income, was $13.61 billion, topping Wall Street's estimate of $13.26 billion.
Another article from the front page, details given on shooting by police. 80-year-old man remains hospitalized. This is written by Anthony Watt. A man shot by East Moline police last week was in critical condition as of Monday. Authorities also said Monday that the service call that ended in the shooting was not the first police call last week involving the man. The 80-year-old, whose name was not yet available, was being treated in a hospital outside of the Quad Cities area, according to the Rock Island County Integrity Task Force. His wounds were considered life-threatening. The task force is a joint police unit comprised of state and local law enforcement. Its job is to investigate incidents such as shootings involving police. The agency being investigated does not contribute officers to the effort. The agency being investigated does not contribute officers to that effort. The incident that resulted in the 80-year-old being shot began when police responded just before 2:30 p.m. on Friday to investigate a report of gunfire at the Hometown Harbor apartment complex located at 1011 49th Avenue, according to the initial news release from the task force. The caller told police that the gunman was the 80-year-old who is a resident of the complex. When they arrived, police found the man, who was armed, and a confrontation occurred, according to the task force. The confrontation ended when one or more of the officers fired their weapons. The officer's gunfire struck the man, and they then disarmed him and secured his handgun, according to the East Moline Police Department. Officers then provided first aid until an ambulance arrived to take the man to the hospital. Neither officer had any serious injuries, according to the East Moline Police Department. They are on administrative leave, a common practice in such situations. Further details about the officers were not available Monday afternoon. More details of what investigators think took place between the officers and the man were also not available Monday, as the task force continued its investigation into the shooting. Friday's police call was not the first involving the man, according to the task force. At about 1:45 p.m. on Thursday, East Moline officers began investigating a report that the man had struggled with an apartment complex employee. Information gathered by the authorities indicates the resident had been angered by landscaping work near his residence and grabbed an employee's arms and then his neck, according to the task force. A struggle ensued and the resident fell to the ground. Authorities took the resident to the hospital so medical staff could examine him for possible injuries to his hip. The task force said the East Moline Police Department gave the details of Thursday's altercation to its community-oriented police officer for follow-up on the resident's actions. Upon completion of its investigation, the task force will hand over the collected evidence to the Rock Island County State Attorney's Office. Prosecutors will then review the evidence to determine if there was any wrongdoing on the part of the officers who responded to the gun call. The East Moline Police Department will also conduct a review of the incident to see if its policies and procedures were followed, the department said.
And here are a couple stories from the local page 3 of the Quad City Times. This one is entitled, John Anderson, CEO of QC Bank, Planning to Retire, written by Gretchen Teske. Longtime Quad City Bank and Trust CEO John Anderson will retire early next year. Anderson is a 40-year veteran of the banking industry with 26 total years at QCBT, including 17 as CEO. Under Anderson's leadership, Quad City Bank and Trust saw significant growth and prosperity, according to a news release. When he first took the helm in 2007, QCBT had a total asset size of $600 million. That has now grown to $2.6 billion. In the same time, QCBT has grown from number 10 in market share to number 1, the release said, and the number of employees has increased to 155. QCBT's trust department has also grown, with $5 billion in assets under management and $5 billion in safekeeping assets. Anderson has been active in the Quad Cities community throughout his career as well, serving on various boards, including at St. Ambrose University, Genesis Foundation, Vera French Community Foundation, and Diocese of Davenport Foundation. It has been an amazing journey from my first job as a cash vault teller at Davenport Bank to serving as CEO of QCBT for the past 17 years. I have been able to witness the impact that a community bank has on the community, and it has been a gift. Watching the Quad Cities grow and prosper has been a personal blessing for me, Anderson said in the release. Anderson's retirement will become official as of January 3, 2025. Laura Divitt Ekizian, E-K-I-Z-I-A-N, will be the next CEO. She has served as President and Chief Relationship Officer for QCBT for the past 4 years of her 24-year tenure at QCBT. While I am excited and honored to serve QCBT in the role of president and CEO, I am also mindful of the legacy Anderson has imparted on this company, she said. His commitment to the Quad City community and to our work as a community banking organization is what we will continue to focus on. I am looking forward to working with our entire team at QCBT to continue our 30-year history of serving this community and being worthy of our name. And here's an article, Silva Schools Leader Van de Wiel receives Regent Honor, written by Olivia Allen. On Thursday, the Illinois Association of School Administrators named Silva Superintendent Terry Van de Wiel as the Blackhawk Region's 2024 Superintendent of Distinction. She was honored Thursday alongside 20 other regional superintendents of distinction at the IASA's 10th Annual Awards Luncheon in Springfield, featuring Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders. Van de Wiel touts a 29-year-long career in education, serving as the Silvis Superintendent for 9. Being recognized as a Superintendent of Distinction is a great honor, she said in a news release. The work that I do would not be possible without the dedication and support of the Board of Education, community, parents, students, and employees. Our team works tirelessly to provide students with a well-rounded education in a safe, welcoming environment, she said. Superintendents of distinction are selected by peers in their IASA region based on their commitment, dedication, and leadership. Van de Wiel's colleagues in the Blackhawk region, covering Rock Island, Mercer, and Henry counties, noted a number of successes during her tenure, including adding an 11-classroom elementary school addition, along with geothermal HVAC upgrades, and saving the district $688,370 in refinanced bonds. Also, adding new student supports and programming, such as adding a middle school, JAG, Jobs for America's Graduates program, and a full-time transitions mental health therapist. She also placed behavior support specialists in each district building and expanded interventions for reading and math. Implementing a universal screener and progress monitoring assessments along with positive behavioral interventions and supports, PBIS, at the elementary and junior high schools. And also earning a Capturing Kids Hearts National Showcase District designation from the Capturing Kids Heart organization. As previously reported, Silvis was one of 15 school districts nationwide selected to pilot the District Comprehensive Approach Program via the JED Foundation and AASA, the School Superintendents Association. It's an honor to stand out among distinguished educators in your region and be selected for this honor, IASA Executive Director Brent Clark. I applaud Dr. Van de Wiel for everything she's done to enhance the learning environment for students and propel her district forward, he said. Her leadership has been a difference maker in the Silvis community.
Also from the local page, there is a Meet the Candidates article at the bottom of the page regarding the Scott County Sheriff's Office. The headline says, Pair of Democrats Running for Job. This is written by staff writers. Two Democrats are seeking the nomination for Scott County Sheriff in the June 4th primary. Thomas Gibbs, a lieutenant for the Scott County Sheriff's Office, and Gordon Morse, a corporal with the Davenport Police Department, are vying for the nomination. Both have sought the office before. The winner of the June 4th primary will face one of two Republicans running for the GOP sheriff nomination. Sheriff Tim Lane and Sheriff's Deputy Chris Lay are facing off in that race. Gibbs and Morse answered survey questions sent by the Quad City Times Dispatch Argus. Lane and Lay's survey responses will be published later this week. The first here is Thomas Gibbs. He is 48 years old. His current occupation is a lieutenant in the Scott County Sheriff's Office. His education consists of a high school diploma. His relevant local government or leadership experience is as follows. And I'm sorry, I might sneeze in the middle of this, but no, maybe I'll make it through. I have close to 30 years experience in public safety and security. I am a veteran of the United States Air Force, where I was a military working dog handler. After serving, I worked for the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. I have been at the Scott County Sheriff's Office for over 20 years. I helped start the first ever canine unit for the Sheriff's Office. I have held the rank of sergeant, and currently I hold the rank of lieutenant. For 2 years, I was chief deputy under Sheriff Dennis Conard. I have training in public information duties and have completed leadership classes through FBI, LEEDA, L-E-E-D-A, and FEMA incident command classes up to ICS 400 Advanced Incident Command for Complex Incidents. Now regarding Gordon Morse, he is 52 years old. His education is Associates in Criminal Justice, Basic Crime Scene Technician course, Scientific Content Analysis scan, Interview and Interrogation Techniques Basic through Advanced, NIMS training, which is National Incident Management System, FEMA Center for Domestic Preparedness, KNIFE, FBI Improvised Explosives Course, ATF Advanced Explosive and Demolition School, FBI Post-Blast School, Death Investigations Courses, Death Crime Scene Supervision, National Crimes Against Children Conference, Basic Investigator Course, Electronics for Investigators and Bomb Technicians, FBI Regional Bomb Task Force, Hazmat Technician Certification, ATF Homemade/Improvised Explosives Course, TEAS Explosive Entry/Breaching Course, FBI Large Vehicle Improvised Explosive Device Countermeasure Course, LEAN, or Law Enforcement Intelligence Network, Certified Intelligence Collection and Processing Managing Confidential Informants, and Undercover Investigation/Surveillance Principles and Techniques, FBI Hazardous Devices School, U.S. Army Ordnance Munitions and Electronics Maintenance School. His experience, corporal, street level, and investigations supervision. The staff asked the question of both of these candidates, why are you running for office? Gibbs said, I am running for office of sheriff to move the sheriff's office forward in a position in a positive direction. I have an unwavering commitment to public safety. I want to enhance our community relationships with those we serve. I want the mission of the Sheriff's Office to work in partnership with our community to detect and deter crime, preserve the peace, and enforce the laws with equity and fairness of service to all, while ensuring your constitutional rights. In my view, integrity is an essential quality a sheriff should possess. The role as sheriff requires making decisions which significantly impact the community and its members. It is essential to adhere to ethical and professional standards at all times, ensuring transparency and accountability in operations, which are vital to maintaining public confidence within the sheriff's office. I understand the responsibilities of the office and the dedication it takes to serve as sheriff. It is important for any organization to have strong leadership, to build a framework and culture of integrity, professionalism, and teamwork, and I know I can be that leader. Morse's response was, I believe the current views of the sheriff are outdated, and the future demands of the citizens are not and will not be met. The business of law enforcement and how it is done must evolve. We must take action in the area of mental health, its effect on drug abuse, and the burden it puts on the court system. A mental health initiative needs to be implemented and a mental health unit created with a combination of law enforcement, mental health professionals, and social services. The next question asked was, what would be your top priorities if elected? Gibbs replied, if elected, I would like to seek accreditation for all divisions within the sheriff's office. I want to enhance training opportunities in multiple areas, particularly constitutional law and its application towards search and seizure and emergency preparedness. I would like to ensure jail programs are in place to help those in custody to better themselves and help reduce recidivism. I want to build relationships with our community members and organizations to ensure all are heard and help the community understand the sheriff's office's role in public safety. Morse's response was, progression in policing and keeping the public safe, all while keeping the morale high and maintaining public support, forming a cooperative mental health initiative, the formation of a county-wide mental health unit of specially trained officers, mental health professionals, and social service members, restoring the collective bargaining rights of the correctional staff and bringing them up to competitive wages should assist in improving morale, recruiting to fill those positions, and helping with long-term retention. The next question was, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing the county's law enforcement efforts, and what would you do to address them? Gibbs replied, some of Scott County's challenges are coordination of information and resources between area law enforcement agencies, building relationships with the community, and joint training with area law enforcement agencies to ensure efficient and effective operations. In this county, there are many separate agencies, and it is important that we continue to share information pertaining to crime trends and suspects for a coordinated effort combating crime. We should continue to host training sessions and evaluate areas where we can improve community emergency preparedness and safety. We also need to reinstate the Sex Offender Registry Task Force, which brought partners from multiple agencies and disciplines together to share information to enhance coordinated efforts to protect our children. Morse responded, I believe the biggest challenge to law enforcement efforts will be evolving from our long-held beliefs in how we do business. Current crime trends and public demands show we must change. We must be more proactive in how we handle mental health-related incidents. This must be accomplished with specialized training for a core group of individuals. Not every officer is capable of handling these types of calls, even with the best training. By continuing to do business as usual, we put these individuals in situations that could be volatile for all involved. Law enforcement selects people with specific skills and personalities to fill specialized units such as SWAT, bomb squads, crisis negotiators, and specific types of investigations. I believe we must do the same with mental health situations. Another question was, what should the sheriff's office do differently or continue to do to address juvenile crime in the county? Gibbs replied, the sheriff's office should strive to foster positive engagement with youth through intervention programs. We can promote educational opportunities to meet varying needs of juveniles and to serve as a supportive framework for intervention and services for safeguarding the personal development, particularly those juveniles who are in danger or at risk. It is important to partner with community groups to help understand the root causes of juvenile crimes and promote education within the community to minimize opportunities for juvenile delinquency. We need to build community relationships with juvenile court services to promote diversion programs. Morse's response was, the sheriff's office has minimal involvement in the enforcement of juvenile crime in the county. Most of this role is handled by local police departments. Where the sheriff's office does have the most impact is court services. With the ever-increasing juvenile crimes involving vehicle thefts, serious assaults, and gun violence, we must evaluate the handling of those involved during the court process. We continue to see the same core group involved in these crimes. In many cases, during the court process, we see them released to homes with very little interest in supervision or being a positive part of the court process. Changes to the juvenile holding statute several years ago changed the way those serious offenders charged with forcible felonies are held. This has led to those offenders being moved to the juvenile detention center and intermingled with those impressionable juveniles in the system for lesser crimes. When this new facility is finished, I believe the current facility must continue to be utilized in keeping those violent offenders separated from the more impressionable youth. With those forcible felony crimes, the facility would be staffed by properly trained corrections staff who would be able to handle situations like what recently occurred at the Mary Davis facility in Galesburg, Illinois. The building of the new juvenile facility must include increased quality services for all of the youths and include more stringent requirements for parental involvement. And the final question, what in your view are the challenges to staffing the sheriff's office and how would you address those? Gibbs replied, challenges with staffing are happening all around the country and are not unique to Scott County. We need to offer better and competitive pay to attract qualified applicants to fill positions and retraining staff we have in place. We need to create a workplace culture where staff are provided training and support so they have the knowledge to complete their duties and the ability to ask for help when they need or want it. If elected, I will work with the Board of Supervisors to ensure pay scales are competitive to entice a diverse workforce. And Morse's reply is, I believe the biggest challenge we face today is recruiting quality candidates to fill deputy and correctional positions. This is true for almost every department in the United States. To address this, we must make the Scott County Sheriff's Office the most desirable place to work for those interested. We must also work to increase morale, wages, and benefits so those not currently interested in such a career will become so. When I started my career, departments would get 200 to 300 applicants for 5 to 10 openings. Now, you will get 20 applicants. We must also work to restore the collective bargaining rights of the correctional staff, bringing them up to competitive wages, which should assist in improving morale, recruiting to fill those positions, and helping with long-term retention. Setting your officers up for success leads to more positive interactions.
Hey, how about 10 Habits for Good Health? Before we move on, the foundation of a healthy lifestyle consists of lasting habits like eating right, watching your weight, exercising regularly, managing your mental health, and getting routine medical exams. But even daily, small steps toward these goals also can have a significant impact. So here are some practices that can help support your ongoing health journey. While you might find it unrealistic to follow them all the time, try to include them in your daily life as much as possible. Do a morning stretch. Start stretching when you get out of bed. It wakes up the body, it improves circulation, promotes relaxation, it helps to set the day's tone. While you're still lying in bed, move the covers aside, then flex and release your lower limbs several times. Bend your knees, lift your legs into the air. With your legs still elevated, flex your feet up and down and rotate them side to side. Then sit up, slowly lift, look left and then right. Roll your shoulders several times, flex your wrists up and down, and open and close your hands repeatedly. Stay hydrated. Proper hydration supports digestion, improves brain performance, and increases energy, among other health benefits. Drink a glass of water after you wake up and glass with every meal. Floss. Maintaining good oral health includes daily flossing, but make sure you do it right. First, wrap the floss around your middle fingers, which helps you reach the back teeth. Then loop the floss around one side of a tooth so it makes a C shape. There's ways to do it, and they're just telling you the best way. Apply sunscreen. It is the best defense against skin-damaging rays. After washing your face in the morning, apply a facial moisturizer that contains sunscreen with an SPF, sun protection factor, of at least 30, or blend equal parts on sunscreen and regular moisturizer. Use one or two nickel-sized dollops to cover your entire face, neck, ears, and any bald or thinning spots on your head. Go nuts. When you crave a snack, reach for unsalted nuts. I think the key word there is unsalted nuts and seeds like almonds, walnuts, peanuts, and cashews. And also, take a nap. Afternoon naps can recharge a weary body and may boost cognitive function. Study published in 2021 by General Psychiatry found that nappers scored higher on cognitive tests than non-nappers. Well, that's good news. And now, take a breather. Alternate nostril breathing, in which you breathe through one nostril at a time, is believed to help reduce stress by slowing your breathing rhythm and forcing you to take deep, full breaths using a finger or thumb. Close one nostril and slowly breathe in and out through the open nostril. And for a variation, try inhaling through one nostril with the other closed, changing finger thumb positions and exhaling through the previous closed nostril. Bust some moves. Break up bouts of sitting with small bursts of movement. For example, dance across room instead of walk. Okay. Do 10 air squats or push-ups. Enjoy a hobby. A study published online in September by Nature Medicine suggests that having a hobby is good for people's overall health and mood. And be social. Social interactions can stave off loneliness and protect against depression. So those are some good ideas. Dale?
On a program note, you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It is now time for the obituaries from the Quad City Times. We have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them today. Jan Christensen, age 76, of East Moline, passed away Friday, May 17th at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. 10 years of battling health issues due to Agent Orange are finally over. Funeral services are at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 24th at First Lutheran Church in Moline. Visitation is at 4 until 7 p.m. Thursday, May 23rd at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Memorials may be made to Rock Island Rotary Club or First Lutheran Church in Moline. Jan was born on April 9, 1948, to Janice and Vern Christensen in Rock Island. He graduated from Moline High School in 1966 and spent summers at his grandparents' summer house, skiing and boating on the Rock River. He also worked at his grandfather's business, the former Knox Mortuary. He attended Black Hawk College until being drafted into the U.S. Army and sent to Vietnam. Upon returning from Vietnam, he married Diane Eldred on August 2, 1969. Jan graduated from St. Ambrose College with a degree in psychology. He worked at Farmall, and then he and a partner purchased Folda Tank Company from his father-in-law, Giles Eldred. Jan served on the Friendship Manor Board, spent many years in Rock Island Rotary, and was a member and senior warden of Trinity Episcopal Church Vestry. Thank you to Senior Star at Elmer Place staff and care partners for 2 wonderful years of care. Clarissa Cook Hospice House for loving care received in his final weeks, and to his 2-year VA caregiver, Harry, for his time, attention, and care. Online condolences may be left at the website whelanpresley.com. Monsignor Francis C. Henriksen, age 95, a retired priest of the Diocese of Davenport, died peacefully Pentecost Sunday, May 19th, at Solon Care Center in Solon. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Funeral services and Mass of Christian burial for Monsignor Henriksen will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 24th at St. John Vianney Catholic Church, 4097 18th Street in Bettendorf. Burial will be in Calvary St. Irenaeus Cemetery, Clinton, Iowa. Visitation will be held Thursday, May 23rd from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at St. John Vianney Catholic Church, Bettendorf, with a vigil service at 7 p.m. Additional visitation will take place Friday at the church from 9:30 until 10:30 a.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to St. John Vianney, Bettendorf, St. Mary, Fairfield, Priests Aid Society, or the Catholic Messenger. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home has been entrusted with arrangements. Francis C. Henriksen was born on December 16, 1928, in Clinton, a son of Charles and Alice Doyle Henriksen. He graduated from St. Mary High School in Clinton in 1946 and attended Clinton Junior College, Loyola University in New Orleans, Louisiana, before graduating from St. Ambrose College in 1951 with a degree in philosophy. Monsignor Henriksen completed his theology studies at St. Paul's Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and was ordained a priest on June 4, 1955 at Sacred Heart Cathedral by Bishop Ralph Hayes. Monsignor Henriksen's ministry to the Diocese of Davenport spanned almost 69 years. His first assignment was to St. Mary's, Fairfield, before being named managing editor and then editor of the Catholic Messenger, the newspaper of the Diocese of Davenport, a position he held from 1967 until 2002. During his time at the Messenger, Monsignor Henriksen also served as chaplain at Mercy Hospital in Davenport, on the faculty at Davenport Assumption High School, and the parishes of St. Mary's, Davenport, St. Joseph's, Davenport, and retired as pastor of St. John Vianney in Bettendorf on January 15, 1999. Monsignor Henriksen's ministry also included serving on many diocesan boards, as well as on the board of directors of Assumption High School, Genesis Medical Center's Mercy Foundation, and St. Ambrose College, as well as being the vicar for clergy, and of religious for many years. Monsignor Henriksen is survived by a host of nieces and nephews and many dear friends. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting the website hmdfuneralhome.com. David A. Dooley went home to be with the Lord on May 15, 2024, surrounded by his family at the Fountains at the age of 82. The visitation and service will be at the Fountains, 3726 Thunder Ridge Road in Bettendorf, Iowa, June 15th from 1 to 2 p.m. He was preceded in death by his wife, Pamela, his sister, Beverly, and brother, Russell. He greatly enjoyed watching Westerns with his dog, Daisy.
Robert James C.U. Lanahan, it's S-E-I-Y-U Lanahan, beloved husband, brother, uncle, Buddhist, musician, teacher, and textile artist of Brooklyn and Shokan, New York, died too soon on Wednesday, May 8, at his home in Brooklyn, New York, surrounded by loved ones and beauty. Bob was born on June 12, 1964, to Mary Jean and David Lanahan, L-A-N-A-G-H-A-N, in Davenport, where he added music and sweetness to a large and unruly family. At St. Paul's Church School and Assumption High School, he performed with gusto in plays, choirs, concerts, many church services. At a summer crafts program for kids in Garfield Park, he discovered the joy of making things by hand. After achieving a degree in music performance from the University of Iowa, Bob moved to New York City, where he joined his brother, Mark, and met his life partner, artist Matt Yanchuk. As a high school music educator, Mr. Lanahan led students on music trips and organized countless performances until December of 2023, when he retired due to advancing melanoma. As a choral singer, he last performed at Carnegie Hall in 2023. Bob leaves a legacy of mindfulness, gentleness, and persevering connection, along with handcrafted articles that were sewn, knit, woven, spun, dyed, and otherwise crafted with beauty and purpose. He is survived by his partner of 35 years, Matt Yanchuk, his siblings, Mark, Kevin, Matthew, Patrick, Brian, and Mary, his brother-in-law, Mike Yanchuk, his sister-in-law, Patty Yanchuk, his nieces, Katie Amos, Molly Peppers, his nephew, Michael Yanchuk, and his cat, Kaylee. He reunites with his parents, David and Mary Jean, his beloved brother, Paul, and other loved ones who preceded him into the next realm. Bob's memory can be honored through the everyday practices of kindness and enjoyment of music and beauty. Margaret Yabara Ruiz. Funeral services of mass Christian burial for Margaret Yabara Ruiz, 87, of Davenport, will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, May 22, at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church in Davenport. Interment will be at a later date. Visitation will start with a prayer service at 4 p.m. and continue until 6 at the Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. There will be additional visitation on Wednesday at the church from 10 a.m. until time of services. Memorials may be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Ms. Ruiz passed on Friday, May 17, at her home. Margaret was born March 19 in Bettendorf, a daughter of Ralph and Jesse Avila Yabera. She was united in marriage to Ronald DeArmond and later to David Ruiz. Prior to her retirement, She had worked for Service Rubber. Market loved to have fun and was the life of the party. She also liked mariachi music, bingo, playing cards, traveling, and making her legendary enchiladas. She was a long-suffering fan of the Cubs and Bears. Survivors include her children, Tammy Buck of Davenport, David Ruiz Jr., Melissa Ruiz of Houston, Josephine Ruiz of Houston, Ron's spouse Tammy DeArmond of Davenport, Jeff DeArmond of Moline, 21 grandchildren, numerous great-grandchildren, siblings, Josephine Yabera of Chicago, Joseph Yabera of Davenport, Les Mananita of Villa Hills, Kentucky, and Mark Yabera of Oviedo, Florida. She was preceded in death by daughter Denise Yabera, parents, siblings, Lupi, Frankie, Tony, Valine, Elvita, Alexander Yabera, and Juanita Overa. Online remembrances may be expressed at www.hmfuneralhome.com.
That does it for the obituaries. I will turn now to the opinion page of the Quad City Times and read this another view from the Dallas Morning News, written by their editors. The title is, "Don't Dismiss Bribery Cases in Congress." Democrats should denounce all corruption, not just the kind that makes GOP look bad. And here is that opinion. No political party ever wants to get caught in a corruption scandal, particularly one flavored by betrayal of domestic interests for foreign gain. Here comes the Democratic Party with two scandals and in a presidential election year. The first has to do with U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, whose bribery trial started last week. The second one involves U.S. Representative Henry Cooler of Texas, who was indicted earlier this month on federal charges of bribery and money laundering. Each man deserves his day in court, and both dispute the charges. Several Democrats have called on Menendez to resign, though Cooler's indictment has largely been met with silence. Democrats shouldn't treat these credible allegations as headlines to be lamented and then forgotten. The party that has decried Russian interference in our democracy and ethical failures by Republicans should reflect on behaviors in its own House that may have invited unscrupulousness. It will accrue to Democrats' favor to vociferously denounce all corruption, not just the kind that makes the other party look bad. The sprawling Menendez corruption case is eye-opening. Federal prosecutors say the senator and his wife accepted bribes in exchange for Menendez using the power of his office to aid Egyptian and Qatari officials, an Egyptian-American entrepreneur, and a New Jersey businessman. A 39-page indictment alleges that Menendez tried to interfere with fraud investigations, disclosed non-public and, quote, highly sensitive, end quote, State Department information to help the Egyptian government, and pressured a U.S. official to protect a halal meat monopoly. In exchange for all these political favors, Menendez and his wife were showered with gifts, ranging from gold bars to mortgage payments and car payments for a Mercedes-Benz, the indictment alleges. If you are letting someone other than your family help you pay for a house or a luxury car, then you shouldn't be in public office. The federal indictment against Cooler and his wife alleges that he used his political influence to shape U.S. policy in favor of Azerbaijan's state-run oil company and to advocate for slackening American anti-money laundering rules to help a Mexican bank. Prosecutors accuse the Coolers of taking bribes disguised as consulting payments for Cooler's wife. The couple has pleaded not guilty. The behavior outlined in the indictment is plainly illegal, but it would be a mistake to think of the charges, if corroborated in court, as mere failures of individual moral character. Loose campaign finance rules contribute to a toxic environment where public servants of all political leanings become enamored with the trappings of wealth, seduced by junkets and extravagant gifts and parties thrown by their donor friends or ideological allies. If Democrats want the moral high ground, They'll take stock of what they have been willing to tolerate and raise the bar for their own.
This next opinion, written by Kathleen Parker, who writes for the Washington Post, is entitled "Butker Does More Than Kick Footballs for NFL Champs." His name didn't click right away when someone texted me in a video of his recent commencement address. But now that Harrison Butker is the focus of a full-blown controversy, let's just say I'm a fan, if not for the reasons you might think. Butker is a 3-time Super Bowl champion kicker for the Kansas City Chiefs. I admit that as I watched the commencement video, I first assumed the bearded man at the lectern was a priest. Given his comments to the graduating class at Benedictine College, a Catholic school in Atchison, Kansas. That is, until he mentioned his wife, at which point I confessed to thinking, wow, I need to pay closer attention to the Vatican. Well, further to my confusion, I don't closely follow professional football. But it didn't take long for the fog to clear. Apparently, Butker's speech May 11 bestirred the urchins and trolls over at X. As you may have heard, he said outrageous things about the importance of marriage and about women as homemakers, and even referred to Pride Month as a deadly sin. It's in quotes. Talk about blasphemy. I fear for this man. To each his own opinion, but in today's culture of inclusion and diversity, one can hardly do worse than advance ideas that are fundamentally countercultural. He is a revolutionary. But the mass outrage over a Catholic football kicker's speech at a Catholic school is laughable. Some 100,000 people have signed a petition to get this 58-yard kicker fired from his job. His sin? He expressed thoughts that offended 130,000 people who weren't at the graduation. At Benedictine, Butker received a standing ovation. Nonetheless, the NFL felt compelled to issue a statement saying his comments, quote, don't reflect the views of the league, end quote. Ah, good to know. Did I mention Butker can kick a football 58 yards down a field so that it flies between two goalposts 18.5 feet apart and over the 10-foot-high horizontal bar? That should be enough to gain entry at the heavenly gates. Excuse me. But Butker is also a serious Catholic who was invited to give a commencement address by a Catholic college. His goal was to critique a culture that, to say the least, isn't everybody's cup of tea. Most people of a certain age don't recognize much of what passes for American culture today, including the inclination of some to censor or cancel the thoughts of others. American universities and college campuses are among the unsafest places in the world for the free exchange of ideas. At my very last university speech in 2016, I was assigned an armed security guard because of protests preceding my engagement and a demand that I not be allowed to speak. Apparently, a hardline feminist professor had read my book, which is Save the Males, to her class, and the little darlings were apoplectic. To his credit, Elon University President Leo M. Lambert stood his ground against the protesters, and I was allowed to speak. During a Q&A session, some of the budding feminist students asked me to explain something I'd written on page whatever. I stopped the first one mid-sentence and said I couldn't explain because I hadn't read the book. Growing numbers of comedians refuse to perform on college campuses because humor necessarily offends someone. Irreverence, once the operative value in student union hubs, is now viewed as mean. I don't agree with everything Butker said, but I will defend him against cancel culture. Nobody gets to decide who gets to say what. Perhaps most alarming to the digital mob were Butker's remarks directed at women in the audience, whom he characterized as victims of the, quote, most diabolical lies, end quote. He was referring to the lie that careers and titles would make women happy instead of one of the most important titles of all, homemaker. Oh, honey, what were you thinking? This is in italics. Butker was thinking of his wife, Isabel, who is a homemaker, being a homemaker is enormously gratifying, especially when one has young children in tow. But homemaking and catering needn't be mutually exclusive. You just need staff. Well, it would be nice, wouldn't it? Hard truth is that few women can afford to sign up for homemaking these days. Butker ignores this reality because he can. He earns $4 million a season. Somehow, I plan to muddle through the week without fear that Butker will radically alter the rotation of the earth around the sun with his words. But I admire his courage in articulating a message many probably relished hearing. Rather than offer a mealy-mouthed apology to appease the we-minded, the NFL should have defended Butker's right to speak his mind. But then, that would have required courage and risked the wrath of the easily wronged.
Thanks, Doug. We'll turn now to the sports page of the Quad City Times. At the top of the page, there's an article written by Samira Mala about Illinois girls soccer. Pioneers find form late in the season. On May 27, 2023, Almond fell to Normal University 1-0 in overtime in the Class 1A state championship soccer game. Almond was bidding for its first state title. This year, this upperclassman heavy roster has not had the same success, finishing the regular season with a 3-8-2 record. After a 15-4-1 record last season, there was a reason their record fell off, despite a roster returning 14 juniors and seniors combined. At the end of the last year, I thought we needed more competition on our schedule, and I pretty much changed it completely for this year. Almond head coach Randy Bowman said that. He continued on, "We added quite a few big 2A and 3A teams from Illinois and added Bettendorf, who has a 13-3 record, to give the girls more of a challenge," end quote. As part of their 13-game gauntlet, the Pioneers faced Morton with a 16-2-1 record, Richwoods, a 20-3 record, Dunlap, who are 14-6, Bettendorf, and Peoria Notre Dame, which has a 21-1-1 record, dropping all five by the combined score of 13-0. However, Almond has turned the tide in the playoffs. The Pioneers blanketed Genoa Kingston 7-0, with five of those goals coming in the second half in the 1A regional semifinals on Tuesday. Almond then added four more goals in a 4-1 victory over Byron in the regional semifinals. Three different Pioneers, Gretchen Ellis twice, Mackenzie Burkett, and Eliza Kramer, netted goals as the Pioneers broke a 1-1 halftime lead with three second-half goals. "We switched some things up," Bowman said. "Gretchen has really picked it up." Turning to page three, as she was to get forward and get into the attack more. Eliza Kramer switched roles on our team up to a forward role and has definitely given us another dimension to our attack, he said. The Pioneers have only allowed one goal in two regional games after surrendering 1.7 goals per game during their 0-5-2 streak to end the regular season. "The back line that we have, they are all very experienced, as all of them played with us last year," Bowman said of Almond's defense. "They understand the roles that they are supposed to be playing. They are doing a very good job in communicating with each other when needed." Bowman praised his new center back as part of the reason for Almond's defensive fortitude. "Lindsay Britton is usually our outside back for us, but necessity had her move into the middle as a center back," Bowman said of his sophomore. "She has stepped up into that role and has really done well." Up next for the Pioneers is the sectional championship match on Tuesday at 4:30 p.m. against Stillman Valley, who will have an 18-4 record. The Cardinals ended the regular season winning seven of their last eight games, outscoring opponents 27-3 during that stretch. In postseason play, Stillman Valley defeated Rockford Christian with a 10-9-1 record. On Tuesday, they defeated them 3-2 and Oregon, who had an 18-2 record, and the score there was 2-1, on Saturday. I watched their game on Saturday, Bowman said, of the Stillman Valley Oregon regional final game. They have some quality players throughout their middle. We will see if we can match or beat that. I'll keep going. And we've got another minute or two. Maybe I can read you some headlines from the sports page before we finish up. In college baseball, Harding playing key role for Big Ten champs Illini. The subheading said, Moline product has slugged 10 homers this season. And also Straka, S-T-R-A-K-A, advocates for JDC and full level events. The 2023 tourney champ was in town on Monday. And I guess that was from the John Deere Classic. He won that twice before winning here last July. Sepp Straka, and he was in town. And then at the bottom of the page, Clark returns from ankle injury, but fever lose again. There's a photo there of Caitlin Clark on her elbows and knees grimacing. The caption says, Caitlin Clark grimaces after injuring her left ankle in the first half of Monday night's game against Connecticut. Clark did return to the game, but Indiana, her team, lost again and is now 0-4 on the season. All righty. That does bring us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.